Good evening and welcome to Around Cincinnati. I'm Ron Esposito. Tonight we'll be in conversation with one of the greatest record producers in the world, Rick Hall. Everybody knows the music instantly, from Aretha Franklin's Never Loved a Man to Percy Sledge's When a Man Loves a Woman to Alicia Keys' Pressin' On. But not everyone knows the story or the man behind the elusive Muscle Shoals sound. Rick Hall's latest book, The Man from Muscle Shoals, is the compelling memoir of Rick Hall, who came from extreme poverty in rural America to build one of the most famous recording studios in the world and pioneering a new sound that would inspire artists, give birth to new kinds of music, and launch the careers of hundreds of superstars. He wrote, published, and produced hundreds of hit records. Rick, welcome to Around Cincinnati.
Thank you. I'm dying to talk with you about my book. It just came out about 2 weeks ago and flying off the shelves like crazy. And so we're tickled about that. And I've wrote the history of my life. And it started out, of course, as a diary. And I was just making little notes. Wilson Pickett recorded today, Mustang Sally, Funky Broadway, blah, blah, blah. And it turned out somebody said, why don't you write a book? You know, you've got a lot of things to say to the music audience. And so I said, I think I will. I spent 10 years writing the book.
Well, I'll tell you, when you've had a career as long as you have, brother, I can imagine it would take 10 years. And that book that Rick Hall is referring to, it's called The Man from Muscle Shoals, Rick Hall.
And the subtitle is My Journey from Shame to Fame. And, of course, the first question everybody asks me is, I know about the fame, but what about the shame? Where'd that come into the picture at? And, of course, I tell them that, I was born in poverty. I've had a hard life, a tough life, hard to make it in the music world under any conditions, but in my condition, with a high school education, and my father was a sawmiller, and my mother left me and went to a red light district and served, and I never saw her again until I was 15 years old, 14 years old. So things have been tough for me. I lost my father on the tractor accident with the tractor I bought him to make life easier for him. And, of course, my first wife was killed in an automobile accident, and I was driving the car, so I've had a lot of bumps and grinds since I went into business. And the only thing I had to cling to was my music. I made hay with that because otherwise I would have went crazy. I cut the first hit records on Aretha Franklin and Clarence Carter, Otis Redding. I did one record on him. Paul Anka, we had the first number one record in 20 years on him. Mac Davis, we had numerous number one records on him. Baby Don't Get Hooked on Me and Stop and Smell the Roses and, of course, Texas in My Rearview Mirror. We did Marie Osmond. We did Tom Jones. We did Wilson Pickett, Etta James, Dwayne Allman and the Allman Brothers, the Osmonds and all of their hits, and Bobby Gentry in Alabama. A great group of Alabama, who's from Alabama, of course, from Fort Payne. And we produced their last album, or co-produced it. We had four or five producers in on it, and I think I was the best producer they had.
Well, I tell you what, brother, you've had a lot of experience making records.
Thousands of hours. Thousands
yeah.
Of hours
I mean,
studio.
I remember when you were sleeping in that studio.
Oh, yeah, I slept there for days at some points. When I was doing a very important session, such as Aretha or Wilson Pickett or Etta James, Bobby Gentry, blah, 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 and on. But my theory was always that you have the same talent that I have, and God gave you the same mental capacity that he gave me. Then if you work 8 hours a day and I work 16 hours a day, in 1 year's time, I'm going to eat your lunch.
You're my man, Rick. Well, I tell you what, man, we would be remiss if we didn't touch on one of your early successes and a good friend of yours who just passed away recently, Percy Sledge.
Oh, yes. Lordy mercy. We all love Percy Sledge. And to be honest with you, I told a couple of reporters that, of course, everybody's asking me about it. And I didn't produce his records, but I was the guy who made the deal on behalf of Atlantic Records and Jerry Wexler and
yep.
Quinn Ivey, one of the producers, and Marlon Green, the other producer. And they both wrote songs for me. They were exclusive songwriters for me. And so they brought me the record and said, look, what do you think? And I listened to it, and I said, let me hear it again. And they played it a second time, and I said, well, boys, I'll tell you what I think. I think it's the number one record worldwide. I think it's not number two or not number three, but it's the number one record. And so they said, do you know of someone that we can make a deal with and put the record out? And I said, I certainly do. And so I picked up the phone and called Jerry Wexler in New York City. In fact, he was living at Great Neck at the time. And he said, well, Rich, send me a copy of it. So I sent him a disc up there, and he called me back and said, Rick, I'm sorry, but I don't hear the record. I really don't hear a hit there. And I said, well, have you lost your hearing? And he said, well, I hope not. And he said, do you really think it's number one? And I said, I think it's number one. I would bet my life on it. It's a number one record worldwide. And, of course, the rest is history. But he said, well, I'm going to make a deal with these guys based on your feelings about it. And I'm going to give you a 1% finder's fee for finding the record for me. And I'll put one of your records on the B-side and let you publish the B-side of it. And I said, well, thank God for that. I mean, I need all the help I can get here. That happened, and of course, Percy, all his records were cut here in Muscle Shoals, and they were Monster Records, and he was a wonderful, wonderful man. He was gentle, kind, sympathetic, easygoing, always had a friendly smile, and everybody loved Percy. I mean, he was that kind of guy, and he had a voice like no other. Bolton covered the record, Michael Bolton, but didn't sell Doodle Squad because he was copying Percy, and nobody could sing the song like Percy Sledge sang it.
There's another area of your career that really interests me and that should be of interest to any musician listening to this interview, and yeah. That's about music publishing. How did you get into music publishing?
Well, I tell you what, I was a songwriter in my early career and a musician. Of course, I played gigs, and everybody had a band down south because that's the only way we could make a living down here. So somebody said to me, said, well, why don't you publish your songs because you're a good songwriter? And I'd had hit records by Roy Orbison. I'd had big hit records on Brenda Lee and George Jones and all the country people in Nashville and that. And so they said, why don't you start a publishing company? And so I did start a publishing company, and we called it FAME, F-A-M-E, which was named after Florence, Alabama Music Enterprises. And, of course, we took the first letter of each word, and it spelled FAME. And we said, my God, we need to name the publishing company FAME Publishing Company. And Billy Sherrill came out of that group. He went to Nashville. And he was a pop artist and a pop man. He loved mm-hmm. pop music. And I was his country's homemade soap. And so I went into the black market and did all the black acts in the early 60s while George Wallace was standing in the schoolhouse door at the University of Alabama saying, white now and white tomorrow and white forever. And we come under a lot of scrutiny during the 60s, but we were cutting hit records in Muscle Shoals while the South was burning down.
That was a really interesting phenomena because...
Incredible.
It was, because I tell you what, particularly your work with Atlantic, you cut almost every major soul artist in the 60s that everybody was dancing their rear ends off to.
Yeah, well, I did. We did Joe Tex.
Yeah.
We did all of King Curtis's records.
Ooh.
We did the Tams, What Kind of Fool Do You Think I Am, and on and on. and the Gary U.S. Bonds, and I can't name all of them. But,
right.
But the ones I wrote down and made note of was Aretha Franklin, Clarence Carter, Otis Redding, Paul Anka, Mac Davis, Marie Osmond, Tom Jones, Wilson Pickett, Etta James, Dwayne Allman and the Allman Brothers, the Osmonds, all of their hits, all their number one records, and, of course, Bobby Gentry, and, of course, she was one of my all-time favorite artists.
Uh-huh.
Didn't happen quite as big as we'd hoped it would, but it was a big record. It was called Fancy, and it was a follow-up to Ode to Billy Joe. And, of course, Alabama, which is sold 5 million albums every release they had. 5 million albums was a lot of albums in my day, because I thought, well, I don't want to be country. And of course, I was a fiddle player. As I told you earlier, Jim Stewart was a fiddle player too, so we were cut from the same piece of cloth.
Yeah, I remember in your book, The Man from Muscle Shoals, Rick Hall,
yes,
you would actually have the horn players on Aretha and Wilson's records playing, you know, the
fiddle lines.
Yeah, because you guys were doing head arrangements. You weren't going in there with stock arrangements and everything written down.
Yeah. We were opposed to that because we felt like a team of great players and great producers. In fact, most of my pickers that played on my sessions were in their own right record producers, and very big and good record producers. Joe South was in that group, and he did Games People Play and Yo-Yo that I did on the Osmonds later. He had Done in the Boondocks with Billy Joe Royal and all that stuff. And then we had Bobby Womack. He was a great songwriter and a big fan of Wilson Pickett's. We had people like that were producers actually playing guitars and horns and so forth on the sessions. And so we did better than some string arranger who hides in the basement and writes string arrangements to a song that nobody likes. So if he's wrong, then the world's wrong. But we had 10 people producing our records, and they were all playing off of each other. The guitar player may come up with a great line. And I say, as a producer, I would say, wait a minute. The guitar's got the lick. Chip's moment is on top of it, man. Everybody switch what they're playing and play along with him, okay? That's how we did here in Muscle Shoals. And nobody could read music. We didn't know how to read music. We just played from the heart. That's where we were different from New York and Los Angeles and Memphis, Tennessee, and so forth.
I think people ultimately at the end of the day want an emotional experience when listening to music.
Thank you. Yes. And they want something they can dance to. If it's a happy song, they want to be the happiest song they've ever heard. If it's a sad song, they want to be the saddest song they've ever heard, and so forth. You have to play open-minded, and you have to bend or be blown up the roots.
I tell you what, man, it's been such a pleasure talking with you.
Well,
thank you for taking the time.
Sir. I appreciate you being able to let me call you and talk over some of these things with you, because I love you and I appreciate everything you've done for me in the past and in the future, anything you can do.
All right, Rick. Take care, brother. We'll see you.
Yes, sir. Have a good day.
Okay. We've been in conversation with Rick Hall talking about the Muscle Shoals music experience, and Rick's latest brand new book is called The Man from Muscle Shoals, Rick Hall, My Journey from Shame to Fame. And more information about Rick Hall can be found at wvxu.org/AroundCincinnati. I'm Ron Esposito.